I'm an addict named Trey. First of all, I'd like to thank my high power for allowing me to see another day clean. Because I know it's truly, truly, truly a blessing to stay clean on a daily basis. Secondly, I'd like to thank the convention committee for thinking enough of my recovery to ask me to come down here and do a workshop. But when I got the call at work, probably about a month and a half ago, and the guy told me his name and told me what he was representing and said, you know, we're thinking about letting you come down and do a convention, do a workshop. And my first thought was, I should have got this call 3 years ago. You know. My ego kicked up real quick. You know what I mean? It's about time. How they kept overlooking me. You know what I mean? And all of that just went out the window when the guy said, we're about to introduce our first speaker. I didn't have to use the bathroom until I stood up right now. But again, I'm Trey and I'm an addict. And that laughter just made me calm down just a little bit. And that's my first experience with any type of recovery is laughter. A good friend of mine that's in this room right now, I was about to go in treatment, didn't know what I was expecting, didn't want to go in treatment, didn't know anything about Narcotics Anonymous, any type of recovery program. And when I met this guy, the first thing he had to tell me was a joke. And at that point, well, nothing funny. When the guy asked me to do what I like to speak on the third step, my gut flipped. Because my sponsor always tells me that honest sharing brings freedom. And I knew that if I came down here and I had to speak on the third step, that everything that came out of my mouth would have to be the truth. See, this is the first step that mentions the word God in it. And God can be whatever you want him to be. The literature tells us that. The God that you choose is totally up to you. But when he asked me to speak on the third step, I said my gut flipped, because even though I've worked the third step and I've moved beyond it, it's something that I have to practice on a daily basis. And at the time that he asked me to do the third step, was right in the midst of me having to rely on the third step. So nothing is out of order. But I know before I got to the third step, I had to work two prior steps. And my story starts probably just like everybody else's. I was the guy who, I'm from North Carolina, born and raised. Grew up in a family where there was just a mother, my sister, and me. My mother worked all the time. My sister was older than me, and we had got to that age where, you know, sisters and brothers fight every day. And I remember coming home from football practice. I was in the ninth grade. I think I probably was in the eighth grade. And I remember coming home from football practice and the type of thought process I grew up with was that if a man worked hard all week long, he deserved and treated himself with a beer on Fridays. That's the thought pattern I had, right? And my thought pattern told me that since I had just worked hard at school and at practice, that I deserve a beer when I got home. And my mom worked second shift, and my mom drank, so it was nobody there but me and my sister. And my sister at that point didn't care what I did as long as I left her alone while she was on the phone. And I remember coming home from practice, going to the refrigerator, taking that beer and walking outside. And we had a little land, so, you know, for me to walk outside and down in the woods was nothing. And I did not know that that can of beer would take me on a ride. A 10-year interrupted ride that landed me in Washington, D.C. on 16th and Park Road, trying to get one more. Because after a while, the beer didn't work anymore. And after a while, I got a little bit older. And in the South, my mother used to tell me that I was smelling myself. And so the older I got, the more I started to smell myself. And what that meant was that I started to think that I can do what I wanted to do versus what my mother wanted me to do. And what that led on was for me hanging with guys, girls, people that were much older than I was. And if you hang with the older crowd, and if you want to be cool, you got to do what they do. So from 13 to 15, I think about 15, I started experimenting with marijuana. Still hanging out, still thinking I'm grown. Nobody can tell me anything. And I think about 17, I started experimenting with marijuana and coke mixed together, called it Woolies. And I remember I was a senior in high school, and my English teacher pulled me out of class one day. Class was going on. She just stopped and she said, "Trey, let me speak to you for a moment outside." And I said, "Okay, Miss Jordan." And she came out and I came out. She said, "I keep walking past you and I keep noticing this smell on you." And I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And she said, "It's a strong smell of alcohol and marijuana." And right then I went straight in denial. "I don't know what you're talking about." As a matter of fact, my mom didn't wash last night. Lies already. My mom didn't wash last night. This is my cousin's sweater. He does those things, and this is all I had to wear to school today. And she said, "Well, if that's the case, I'm sorry for the way your family is right now. And I'm sorry for bringing you outside embarrassing you." And I said, "It's okay." You know what I mean? And continued on. Never looked at the fact that maybe then something was wrong. But again, managed only through the grace and a mother who did not play to graduate from high school. And continue to use after school. After I got out of high school, I managed to try to go to college. My sister stayed right across the street from the college, so I moved with her, got into college. But what I learned here is I always took me. So I took the attic right into a university where there were other kids trying to get their education who were more fortunate than I was, who had probably two parents and a guardian sending them money, and I would manipulate them to get the money, let's just get high, and I'll figure out a way to get it back to you. Needless to say, I got put on academic probation I knew it was time for me to leave school before I got kicked out. Moved back home with my mother, and I think then my using really, really took off. I remember I was working a job. It was nobody there but me and my mother. She got paid on Thursday. I got paid on Friday. She would take all her money and pay the bills, buy food, buy grocery. Come Friday, she would just ask me for $40 or $50 to help out. And I told her I'd give it to her tomorrow, which is Saturday. And Saturday would come, and I didn't have a dime to give my mother. And I would have that dumb look on my face, and I would try to make up excuses. Well, Mom, I went shopping, and hadn't bought nothing. And I think at that time, I was about 20. Hadn't really got into the serious drug. Was just still just smoking Woolies and drinking alcohol. And I remember I had a cousin that came down from this area, from Maryland, talked to me and asked me what I was doing with my life. You know, did I want to end up like the rest of the guys that were locked up, caught up in the system? And I said, you know, I'm doing fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with me. He made me an offer to come up to Maryland and try to get my life together. Needless to say, I did that. Came up here, brought the same addict, and I managed to stay around here for about a year until my disease forced me to pick up the phone and call my mother and tell her I had a problem. First time ever getting honest. Because what happened in February of 98, I was 22 years old, and this cousin that asked me to move up here with him had begun to smoke crack. And I knew that was not for me. I would never do anything like that. Seeing what it did to other people, I had a brief stint at trying to sell it. So I knew, you know, it wasn't for me. And I remember me and a young lady I was dealing with at the time had a real nasty breakup. And I couldn't talk about what I was feeling at the time because the cousin that I was around, he didn't want to hear that. He didn't want to say, my feelings were hurt. You know, I love her. He didn't want to hear none of that. And I remember coming home from work one day, and he was doing what he do best. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to have me one woolie, and I'm going to go to bed, and I'm going to think about this thing. And he was at the table, and I was doing what I was doing. He was doing what he was doing. But he looked like he was having a little bit more fun than I was. And I said to myself, consciously, I'll never get hooked on it. And I said, let me try that one time. And that was in February of 98. In September of 98, I was through. In September of 98, between that span from February to September, I did everything. Everything I said I would never do, I did just to get one more. In June, I left Maryland and went back to North Carolina, went back to my biggest enablers. Guys I grew up with, my mom, my grandma, my sister, and I took them through literal hell, and from June to September. I come from a very, 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 very small town, and the town I come from, everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows that you're such and such child by such and such, you know. And when my disease got real bad, my mom was totally embarrassed, but that didn't stop me. I knew the town was talking about me, but that didn't stop me. One day I just got a bright idea that I'll come back to Maryland. Those guys that, see, the reason why I had to leave in June, because some people were looking for me. And I thought by September they had forgot about me. Knew at that point they wasn't getting their money. And I got a bright idea one day because I had burnt all my bridges from June to September in my hometown. So now I had to run again. And my thinking told me to run back to this area. I told my mom I wanted to come back. She said, "Where are you going?" And I'm saying, "I just need to go." And at that point, I think she was just so tired of what I was taking her through. She said, "What I'll do is I'll buy you a bus ticket. I would not put any money in your hand." And she bought me a bus ticket, her and my aunt. And I remember my aunt, my mom's sister, telling me before I got on that bus, she said, "Trey, please do something with yourself." That was her last word she said to me before I got on the bus. And I got back up here, and I'm at the bus station, and I'm standing at the bus station like, who am I going to call? Came back up here with nothing but a bag. And I remember the guy I used to work with. I think he knew that something was wrong back then, because he tried to take me to church with him a couple of times. And it's like, "Trey, you come to my house," you know what I mean? And I think it was more or less he couldn't understand how a guy his own age could be destroying his life like this. And I called that guy and I told him, "Hey, look, man, I'm back up here. I need somewhere to stay. I just need to get a job and a gal and a apartment, I'll be all right." And he said, "Trey, you know what? I just got married. My wife is not going to go for it." He said, "The best thing I can do is put you up with a friend of mine who has about 2 weeks left on his apartment, and I'm pretty sure he'll let you stay with him." And he called the guy, said, "Yeah." I had met the guy prior when I was staying up here before. And the guy said, "Yeah, I could stay." And just to make it real simple and plain, I brought me back. And that guy didn't know me. He knew the guy, Trey, from work, came over, drunk a couple beers, and left. He didn't know the addict in full blast, Trey. And if within a week, I remember one night particularly, and this just goes straight to my bottom, is that we were drinking. And that beast woke up and said, "Trey," because that's how my disease talked to me. "Trey, you know what we really want. And find a way to manipulate. And I did. I said, "Man, let me run to the store, get some more, because we're running low." And guy gave me a $50 bill and the keys to his truck. And that was probably about 9:30. When I came back, it was about 6:30 in the morning. I wasn't coming back to bring him his truck. I was coming back to steal something out of the apartment. The guy was up. He had a friend of his. He said, "Man, all I'm going to ask you to do is leave, because I should call the police on you." Guy took a swing at me, and needless to tell you, I picked up somebody while I was out there, and they were with me, and they were saying, "Please, no fighting. He can come with me." And the lady took me at 6 in the morning to some friend of hers' house on 16th and Park Road. Never been there in my life. I continued to use all that day. And at this guy's house we were at, the guy, we used all that day, And I was, the guy at that time had to have been probably about 60 or 70 years old. And I was his grandson all that day. This is my little grandson. Everybody came, this is my little son. And the very next day when I came to, the guy was sitting in the chair, the girl was gone. I woke up and the guy said, you know, we had fun last night. You know, for a young guy, you really can go. He said, but I don't know you that well. So I'm going to ask you to leave. And I said, okay. And I remember walking out of the apartment complex, walking and standing on 16th and Park Road, not knowing whether to go left or right, because I had never been there in my life. And the only idea I could come up with was to stop a police officer. Because I knew prior, when I was up here earlier, that I had got a traffic violation and I had a warrant out on me and I missed court and I knew they would lock me up and that would give me a time to think. Because my only thinking told me the best place for me to go was jail. At least I have a bed and I'd be safe and I wouldn't be off the I'd be off the street. And stopped the police officer. He came in, stopped the car, rolled up on me. Son, how can I help you? I said, sir, I got a warrant out on me. I want to turn myself in. He says, son. Looked at his watch. He said, I'm about to get off. He said, you could take yourself down to 500 Indiana Avenue, turn yourself in. If you make it in time enough, you can probably get back out today. And he started to walk back to his car. And this was a white police officer. And that doesn't mean anything, but when he started to walk back to his car, I said, sir, I have a drug problem. First step, getting honest. He said, what'd you say, son? I said, I got a drug problem. He came back. He said, let me see your ID. You got some ID on you? And I showed him my ID, and I had just turned 23, probably a week prior. And my ID, I was about 17 because it was my driver's license. And at 17, it really hadn't got that bad. He looked at my ID. He looked at me. Drew the IT to his face. Drew it back. Looked at me like this again. He said, son, what's your social security number? And I told him, and right then the process of my recovery began. I went to jail, spent the night in jail. The next morning, the cop, as he was taking me to jail, told me, if you get to court the next morning, tell the DA you got a problem, and they'll get you some help. Did the preliminaries, went to jail, got up the next morning. I'm standing before the judge like this, no shoestrings, no belt, my pants falling off like this. And judge says something to the DA, DA says something back to the judge. Judge said, Mr. Woods, you're free to go. I said, huh? He said, next case. Be back on such and such day. And I remember walking out of that courtroom, holding up my pants, no shoestrings, saying, God, please help me. I don't want to live like this anymore. I ain't say I want to stop using. I ain't say, you know, I wanted this. I want a car. I said, just please. I don't want to live like this anymore. And got outside and stopped somebody who was probably on their way to work because I was in their way. And because I had nowhere to go. He probably did. But I stopped him and I asked him where was the nearest shelter. And he pointed me down to Second and D shelter. And it's right real close to the courthouse. I went to the shelter. I told them people that I was hungry, homeless, and didn't have nowhere to go. And God said, I can't help you. He said, men's intake is Saturday night, Sunday morning, and this was on a Thursday. I begin to walk back down the steps, and it just felt like a big hole in my gut. And what I understand today was that was the little bit of hope that I had that I can get into the shelter had went away. And I didn't have any more ideas after that. And I'm walking, and the guy comes from behind the booth, the shelter, tells me to go down to the corner to Clean and Sober Streets. They maybe give me some help. I'm saying, man, what is Clean and Sober Street? He said, just go down to the corner, the red door, go up the steps and ask the people the same thing you told me. Went up there, told the people the same thing, and the guy told me I couldn't help you. Because I told him I was hungry, homeless, and didn't have nowhere to go. Guy said, can't help you with that. But if you got a drug problem, you're welcome to come in our program. All you got to do is be in the back of the alley at 5:30 in the morning. Needless to say, I went in that program. I stayed in that program 11 months. I got a sponsor. First 3 weeks of that program, I wasn't no addict, though. I was 23 years old. It really wasn't that bad. You know. I know that I can't do this, and I know that I can't do that. But I just turned legal, huh? And you're telling me it's over with already? But thank God for sponsorship. Thank God for the sponsor I had at the time, because what he told me, he said, Trey, when people don't care how old you are, how young you are, when you get to the rooms like this, the game is over. Started working the steps. First step told me that I was powerless. When I use people, places, things, drugs, whatever, I can't stop, even when I want to stop. Real simple. I had no problem admitting the first step. Second step, they talked about coming to believe in a power greater than myself. I knew a concept of God, but I knew the way that I was living at the time, God was not. God was always there. A high power was always there. But the way I lived was ungodly, so I didn't mix the two. I came to believe in y'all. I met a whole bunch of people who said they did the same things I did, but found a new way to live. All you have to do is follow these simple suggestions. Third step. This power that I found in the second. Now you're asking me to turn my will and my life over to this power. What is my will in my life? Trey, that's your thinking and your behavior. Faith. I had to come to believe and trust that what you guys were telling me, because y'all still was the power. I have a relationship with the God of my understanding today, but early on, it was you guys. I had to trust that what y'all was telling me would work. All areas of my life, not just with my using. Turn it all over, my finances over to people like y'all. My relationships, my attitude. The literature talks about that our relationship, our concept of God doesn't have to come from dogma. What that means is I don't have to have the same God my grandma had, who told me every time I cussed I was going to hell. Y'all told me to find a power that was loving, caring, forgiving. And that's what I did. Shit is. The book talks about at the end of the third step that the same power that brought us to these rooms. So that lets me know I didn't get myself here. If I had any indication that I brought myself here, my story tells me different. That same program that I went to, and the guy told me all I had to do was come in the back alley that night to get in a program. They were doing intakes every 3 months at this specific program. They skipped the month for some reason, did it on the fourth month, the month and the day that I got there. That's all I need to know from that point. When my sponsor pointed that out for me, I was sold. Turn it over? Sure. Because this is the best that I've ever lived in my life. I'm 28 years old. A couple of months, I have 6 years. When I got here, I didn't think I could manage to get a month. But the program of Narcotics Anonymous works. Thank God for a sponsor. Thank God for a sponsee. Because what a sponsee does is he makes you work, even when I don't want to work. Every day is not a good day. And times I do take my will back. And like the literature says, I'll get angry at God sometimes for allowing me. Because what it does, it allows, he loves me so much, he allowed me to kill myself. Clean. But thank God, the literature also says we can always go back to that quiet moment. And we can ask God, real simply, high power, for some of y'all who, you know, don't like the word God, ask that high power just for some help. Willingness. Willingness to just go on with the rest of the program if that's too much to ask. Willingness to work another step. So again, I'd like to thank the convention committee for thinking enough of my recovery to ask me to come out and share my experience, strength, and hope. Thank you.
All right. Trey, thank you very much for sharing with us. Valencia is going to be our second speaker. Valencia.
Hi, I'm Valencia, and I'm an addict. And I want to thank Trey for sharing. I truly enjoyed that. I want to say we can close in the usual manner. For real. Oh, God. I'm an addict who thinks you know everything. Relapse is a part of my story. So when I first went to treatment, I only went to treatment for an oil change. I was messing around with a guy that sold bone, it was pee, and that's what I used. And when he left, my girlfriend said, here, take my Medicaid card and go on in there and clean up for a week and come on back out, and then we'll just do scramble. Okay, fine. So I went to treatment. I wasn't even myself, so I didn't know who they were banging on the door, hollering, Miss Jones, Miss Jones. Like, who the hell is Miss Jones? Oh, shit, that's me for the day. So I had to, you know, open the door. So I stayed there that week, and I never heard that I had a disease. I never heard that. And I stayed there that week, about 10 days, and I cleaned up, and I came out, you know, and I continued, you know, but I just didn't mess with the pee no more. So I continued to get high. And the second time I went, after that entire time, I'm from Wisconsin. So I went back home, and while I was at home, I used, and as just like Trey, I brought, you know, terror to my family. And I became an embarrassment for real. But during that time, my appendix messed up, and I went into the hospital. As a matter of fact, I was on one floor, my mother was on another floor because her kidneys had began to fail. But while I was there, I had surgery, and when I got out, I'm a survivor of incest, but I was having the smells. I couldn't see it, okay, but I could get the smells, you know, that came along with being molested by my uncle from the age of 3 to 6. And some silhouettes of this tall lady with long hair, which would be like my aunt, you know, removing me from my uncle, you know. And I can remember being the smallest in the bed, so therefore my sisters and my cousins would push me forward. So if you know anything about incest or being molested and it's a bunch of kids in the bed, you know that everybody rolls to the back and pushed to the front. So I was that one that just got, you know, pushed to the front a great deal. And I, you know, all that trauma came back because I had suppressed it. By this time I'm like maybe 41. Or 40 years old, and so it came back after, you know, coming out of the, you know, the anesthesiologist and all of that stuff. After coming out, you know, those things started coming back. I said, well, damn, where did this come from? You know, I thought I had kind of pushed that pretty good. But at any rate, in it coming back, right, I started building all these resentments. You know, I hated my aunt, you know, who could have stopped it, you know, and then I thought about it. I said, you know, And then I started to go back in my head and just seeing everything that would happen. And I started remembering when I would see my mother and father getting dressed to go out. I said, oh, hell, that meant I was going over to my Aunt Johnny's house, and that meant Uncle Bill. So, you know, sometimes I would run to my Uncle Grover's, you know, and I would end up staying there with the neighbor down because everybody went out together. You know, when one set of parents went out, everybody was usually going to the same function. But we would always go to Aunt Johnny's house because Aunt Johnny didn't drink. But Uncle Bill did. And so I all of this started coming back to me when I was 40, right? But I was still using. And I was a real good manipulator. And I could manipulate my mother well because I know she didn't like the embarrassment. And we had a club. We, you know, my mother had a tavern, and I could always go to the bar, right, and tell them, you know, give me some money. And they look at me, right. I said, what the hell are you going to do? You want to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning? Because you know she's just going to say yes, so you might as well just give it to me. I don't care, call her, you know, just all this kind of stuff. And so I was in the, it was one morning, I was real sick. And if you ever did dope, you need some legs before you can go out and hit a lick. So I needed some legs. And so she was talking, and she says, well, you know, she was talking about my sister being mad at my stepfather. I said, oh, what the hell? I said, well, she didn't get mad at Uncle Bill. Why the hell is she mad at Eddie? What's up? She said, what are you talking about? I said, look, are you going to give me the money or not? I said, I'm talking about Uncle Bill. You act like you don't know. You know, you act like you don't know how he played and messed with us the whole time. So then she fell back on the couch, and I looked, I said, oh, you don't know, huh? But that let me know how anesthetized and how I didn't, you know, I couldn't even sense other people's feelings. You know, that's how in the grip of my disease I was. I said, well, you're going to give me the money. And sure enough, she gave me the money. But I saw that shit worked, okay? I still wasn't ready to get any help with being molested, but I saw it work to get what I wanted from my mother. At that time, and I continued to work that thing until she had gotten so sick, you know, she had gotten so sick that I said, well, it's time for me to leave, and that was August. That was August of 94, then I came back to D.C., and I went into a program. And that September 15th, my mother died, but I didn't leave Unit 42. I stayed there, and I didn't go to my mother's funeral or any of that. I stayed there because I was scared I couldn't get back. But that still wasn't enough because I still used again, okay? After Unit 42, after the psychiatrist, after the therapist, after everybody, and after I had worked through my incest, and when I say work through it, when you first admit it, you got a knot in your throat, you know, there's a physical thing that I just had to go through. And in going through that, I thought that that was my problem. Mind you, I never heard I had a disease. I thought that was my problem, why I couldn't do things sociably, why I always had to go to the extent and abuse and misuse everything. And after that, I came out, I went to a transitional, got the apartment, got the man, got the car, got all of that, okay, and commenced to experimenting again. And in my experimenting, I did notice that it was no more than 60 days before I had I was hiding the car from the repossession man. I was late on the rent. I had the note. I was going to court, explaining to them that I'll pay 25 on the back. You know, couldn't even make the front. You know, I'm going to pay 25 on the back and all of this. And I was always trying to rob Peter to pay Paul. And until one day, with legs, going to hit a leg, and that's when I got busted. I said, okay. And it was so amazing because you know the point. Everybody knows their own point of surrender. And at that point, when I got busted in Arlington, Virginia, at Nordstrom's, I had some dope in my pocket. I still had the cards that I was playing, and I still had the merchandise, okay? And in the walk, right, I passed four trash cans that I could have dumped the cards, right, swallowed my bags, but I couldn't clean up. You know, I just couldn't clean up, you know, and I just sat there. And even with just one handcuff, I still could have cleaned up, but I was tired, and I knew I was tired, and I knew I didn't want to live like that anymore. And that was one thing about the literature, when it says jails, institutions, and death. I've done the two out of the three. And the last time coming up, when I came through jail, I sat there. But it took me 30 days to lay down. Okay? You throw enough bricks at the penitentiary wall, you know when you go to jail, you go with the attitude of getting out. Okay? And I could not lay down. You know, I just couldn't. I couldn't fall. I said, oh, no, this can't be happening to me. And then my higher put me in a position where money couldn't help. The day I went to jail, I had a court date. The next day, they wouldn't transport me, so nobody would touch me. You know, because I could still manipulate them brothers and sisters that I had, because I was my mama's baby. Now, if she was here, she would do it, da-da-da-da-da. So they started trying to make shit happen, and wouldn't nobody touch me. Bill's mama wouldn't touch me. So I said, okay. Now, this is hindsight for me. I don't know that this is my higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. All I did was ask, you know, for help. You know, I didn't know how it was going to be packaged. I wouldn't have packaged it like that, you know, at all. Shit, I just wouldn't have. And then when they got through with their charges and the three or four or five felonies and the 10 to 20s and all of this that they were saying, right, mind you, I'm still not scared yet. Right? I'm saying, like, man, what's all of this? You know, and the one thing that went across my mind at the time was that I, I can't vote no more. You know, seriously. I was raised, I graduated from college, I did a lot of shit, you know, but then I said, I lost my right to vote. So, you know, yeah, that's it, just like said, boom. And, but later on, as the reality set in, so did the fears, okay? I ended up doing 4 months, and my public defender, you know, kept saying, you don't have a jailable offense. I kept telling my bunk, I said, don't this man know I'm sitting in jail? She said, you don't have a jailable offense. And, you know, she kept telling me, well, you ain't going to the penitentiary. I said, okay, fine. She said, but you don't need to call home as much, because if you do go, they're going to be tired of you. So don't call home that much. You know, here I'm getting all this information, right? I said, okay, fine, whatever. And what started to happen to me in jail is that I started to lose my mind, okay? And I was raised that if anything's wrong with you, you go to that doctor. And so I asked for some psychological help while I was there. And they put me on some medication. They diagnosed me with being bipolar and some more stuff. And all I knew is that I was in jail, and as a result of jail, all of this was happening to me. Do not misunderstand. Because the first step explained to me, and it works how and why on page 9, that I had finally just got to a point where everything I tried stopped working. All the lies, all the justification, everything I knew had stopped working for me. Okay? So I understood that. I truly understood that. I said, but I know I got to have my mind. Because me and my good high buddy, when you get high and you go to philosophizing and talking shit, it was like, oh man, Valencia, what would be the worst thing in the world, right? I'm a golfer. I said, shit, to lose my leg. No, the worst thing would be to lose your mind. I said, okay. And when it started to go, I said, oh, hell no. This can't be here. You know, this just can't be. And so I went and I got help and I got honest and I started talking to that man. And, you know, we was talking about my issues and all of that. And I ended up going to the meetings that, you know, that was brought into the jail by H&I. But I, the one thing that happened for me, though, is that my surrender, I understood that I had to stop fighting, okay? And that was my surrender. And when I came into Narcotic Anonymous, after coming out of jail, my girlfriend would take me to meetings, because she was here before me. She would take me to meetings, and she said, well, you got to find a sponsor. I said, okay, I understand that, you know? And my issue was, I'm so old, how am I going to, you know, trust this young lady to show me how to live, you know? And I was confusing with how to live with how to make a living, okay? I can make a living, you know? I can always get me a job. I can always make me a living, but I ain't know nothing about how to live. And I didn't know that because I was confusing the two. And so she would take me to a meeting, and I kept going, and I kept watching this one young lady, and I kept watching her, and what I liked about her was that she was happy, she could smile, and people gravitated around her, okay? And where I come from, if you don't have friends, okay, then don't nobody want to mess with you. If your family ain't messing with you, don't nobody want to mess with you. These are just things that I was taught that I still hold on to. So I said, okay, she got all of those kind of things. I think I want to go there. And so I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said she would. And she led me through the first three steps, and halfway through my fourth is when she passed. But I know that for me to surrender in the first step meant that I had to just stop fighting. You know, that's the easiest way I could put it. I just had to stop fighting. And fighting to me was trying to do it my way. You know, fighting to me was not being open-minded to hear what you had to say. Fighting for me was knowing, thinking I knew everything, all right? And I went to one meeting. There was a sign up there that says that the most important thing is everything you learn after you think you know everything. That's what it amounted to. Whether it was said like that, but that's what it amounted to. And I started to hear things. You know, I didn't trust individuals when I came in. So my sponsor said, what I need for you to do then is, won't you trust the process? You like who I'm becoming, so you need to trust the process that made me who I am becoming. So I said, okay, I could do that. And I could always read literature. So that's what I started doing. And I started reading a lot of literature. And I liked reading the literature because the literature didn't have a story with it. You know, I didn't have to work so hard to understand what you was feeling, because your blow-by-blow was a little different than mine. You know, so sometimes an open discussion meeting got kind of difficult for me. It was like going to work. And it said in the first step that this, I can surrender when I know that I'm here and it's not a job. So I had to start going to step meetings, because open discussions was becoming a job, and I am who I am. I'm nosy as hell, and you didn't finish. Like, what the hell happened? You know, I'm like listening to this story. I want to know what the hell happened, you know, and you wouldn't finish. So I wasn't getting it. So when I started going to step meetings, and I had a little text behind it, I was able to understand, and I was able to relate to your feeling. You know, I listened to Trey's story, and I could understand all the feelings of degradation, the choice that I decided, you know, to just make myself degradable, because that's what I did when I chose to do what I did. And I didn't do it in the same manner he did, but we had the same feeling. And that's what my sponsor and working the first three steps gave me. It gave me the ability to come in here, listen to you, and identify with the feeling and stop trying to identify out, because I didn't do it like you did it, but I felt what you felt. And that I had to learn. And coming to believe, that wasn't difficult for me. And I knew I was insane, because sane people don't do what the hell I did. So I didn't have a problem with that part. My problem was the restoration, when it called on the new thinking to apply to the situation before I acted a nut. You know, that's what coming to believe helped me do. And in that second step, it also says that you act as if what you hope for is going to happen. That freed me so much. It wasn't that I could pretend, all right? I honestly believed what I hoped for would happen, whatever the situation was, okay? Whatever I had done, I believed what I hoped for could happen. And I believed it. Not only did I believe it, then I started walking and acting like it. You know, and then sometimes my friends and my network would say, you know, like, it's not a mental gymnastics, I should say, okay? It's my honest to goodness faith, all right? Because you're going to believe something. If you ever think about it, you won't go a moment without believing something. My belief, I choose to just put on the positive side. You can be stuck in a project and believe that's the only place you're going to be, you know. But I choose to believe that I have hope and what I hope for is going to happen. And I have a ton of evidence, because I had a sponsor that I looked at, that I wanted what she had, and I go to meetings and I see you all. So I have plenty of evidence that this works, you know. And I can believe when I see. That's easy. Then but my faith kicked in, because I wanted something other than what I had when I got a taste of it. And once I got a taste of it, I realized that the only reason I got a taste of it is because I was open-minded. If it was just for that moment or just for that day, I exercised some open-mindedness to allow whatever suggestion was given, that I didn't have to know the outcome. All I had to do was just try it. You know, just try it. That's all I had to do was just try it. I didn't have to know if it was going to work. And that's practicing open-mindedness for me. Also, when the second step, it gave me a lot of hope, okay? And I needed hope. I needed to know that it was going to get better. I really, truly needed to know that it was going to get better. And then the third step, by coupling my ability to surrender, okay, and by knowing that or believing that there was a power greater than me that could restore me to sanity, I was able to call him God, okay? And my God is loving, kind, forgiving, walks on water, all-powerful, all-knowing. And that for me, when I had to start turning my wheel over, it was like I'm saying, all right, now, how do I do this? I said, I'm really kind of tired of going to these meetings and everybody keeps saying, turning it over, when I share my experience, and I mean, nobody told me how to turn it over. You know, I was getting, you know, frustrated. I said, how do you turn it over? And it works how and why. To me, it's just like a simple roadmap, you know? The third step in there is a simple roadmap of how it goes. And then turning it over for me was that whatever it is, whatever situation that I knew I could not control, okay, I had to turn it over. And when I say not control, I don't mean run. I mean that the practical application of doing what I can do. If I can't do the next right thing, all right, and I have to wait on that outcome. So for me to practice the third step, it's for me to get out of my way, okay? It's for me to move away from being the self-willed individual, which will be self-centered, defiant, knowing everything, or thinking I know it all. I have to move away from that individual. And also, the one thing that I did like about the third step is it says in it that by making the decision to do this step, okay, and the relationship that results, it will revolutionize my existence. That was so powerful. Revolutionized my existence. I said, okay, let's try this thing. So I knew that as a result of whatever it is, if I could just get up every day, do the next right thing, okay, and leave the outcome to God. I said, oh, hell, this is all right. Because then I got a lot of freedom. And like I said, it'll liberate us. It won't. The step says that it will not stop us from having to make an action, but it'll liberate us from having to worry, excessive worryingness is how it says, about the results. And that's where I stayed. I had 4 felonies, you know, and I had to find a job. You know, I wanted to manipulate that shit. I didn't want them to ask me those questions on there. But I had to just, you know, let it go. And it became easier and easier the more I practiced it. And the more I practiced it. And I do know that determination, courage, those are the things that I had to use in order to change. And as a result of changing, I live better. I like it. You know, and my sponsor always says that if you can do anything for 30 days, it can become a habit. You know, so when we work our step work, you know, I'm given an assignment at the end of those 30 days, at the end of that step, to do something in that for 30 days so that I can start to practice it. And the things in the third step that I'll have to practice is I just have to remove me. You know, I have to, like, move away from being self-centered. Whenever I think that I want to control or run something, then I have to practice this step. And I have to ask God to help guide me so that I can stop being my old self. And my old self kicks up often. It kicks up a lot. It kicked up today. I'm like, okay, I can't share first because I don't know nobody in here to keep me honest. And half my buddies in the other room, they got to come in here so I can see them and look up. I said, okay, you know? And I said, okay, Lord. And then my other girlfriend over there, Sharon, said, now, why can't you just let it be? I said, okay, I'm going to let it be, but I'm still not going to go over here and go first. If you're going first, I need them to come over here after they support you so that I can keep myself honest, you know? And whatever I need, I know how to ask for today, too. So. My name is Valencia, and I'm an addict. Thanks for letting me share.
All right, I'd like to thank you both for sharing. If we could just have a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer to wrap up the meeting. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change.